Where do we start this? An answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls.
I'm tweeting that puppy.
Okay.
And welcome into a special edition of Sell or Die, our best of April and May episode. I am your producer and voice of God, Doug Branson. We have a great selection of clips. We actually doubled up because we did not do a best of April episode. So now for you today, we have a best of April and May. And first up is Jacob Badsgaard, the founder of Disruptive Advertising. Now, if you remember, this was a wide-ranging interview that discussed entrepreneurship, advertising, and the founder mentality, and transitioning from the founder mentality into one of sales teacher. So go back and listen to that episode because it was a really important episode. But in this clip that we have for you today, Jennifer, Jeffrey, and I chat with him about the Tinderization of advertising. Don't swipe left.
We compare disruptive advertising to Tinder. We're all the other agencies are the ones you swiped left on, and we're the one you're finally going to swipe right on. And then we go through the progression of how we're going to make a bunch of money babies together.
What's Tinder? Wait. What's Tinder?
Tinder's a dating app.
I know
app.
What it is.
Oh, okay.
So we definitely love to push the envelope with those types of things.
Money babies. I like that.
If you like me and you like our ads, swipe right.
Swipe right.
That's funny. That's totally funny.
Oh, man.
What's amazing? The meme that Tinder has created is
the swiping left or swiping right.
Yeah. You know, I don't like you. You're out. Left. Mm-hmm. I like you. Swipe right. And Jacob has taken this to the next level.
Well, now I'm wondering what kind of advertising would Jacob swipe left on?
Right.
What kind of advertising out there do you see and go, I'm not really, yeah. I don't think this is on trend. I don't really like this.
Here's the thing. I find that a lot of people, you know, coming back to that same point, a lot of money is wasted.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the things that I see, the swiping left on that I see happening in the advertising world where waste occurs is most people still treat digital like a media buy. Hey, we're just going to spend X amount on digital.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Hold on one second. Not only is a media buy, but through a traditional agency.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't know a Facebook page of their own if they fell over it, or they have 928 Twitter followers.
Right.
That's not the guy I want to do business with.
Not at all. And here's a contrasting approach. Hey, we're going to spend $10,000 on Facebook. So we select a generic audience and we spend $10,000. And most businesses say, hey, I'm not generating any return for my Facebook ads, which is what most tell me, right? Versus this approach. The clients that are most likely to buy from you are who? It's the people that have already bought from you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can just export all of the people that have ever bought from your business before, upload that list into Google and Facebook, and target them and them only, and get you repeat purchases. And you might spend pennies on the dollar to do that, and the return is dramatically different, right?
Huh.
And so what I swipe left on the things that I don't like are stop wasting money and approaching digital. You can get so targeted. There's no reason to waste that much money on digital.
I'm curious, yeah. Jacob, your thoughts on some of the recent developments in basically trying to find return on investment and putting videos on Facebook and trying to get some ad revenue going there. We had the recent news that Vox Media is laying off a lot of their division that was created to create, you know, social media videos and Facebook videos that were supposed to generate ad revenue and just didn't. And a lot of that had to do with Facebook and their metrics not matching up completely. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that development in the digital ad space.
Yeah. You know, at the end of the day, to trust one platform's information that they're providing you is typically, I would not recommend that anyway, right? That ad revenue and those clicks and things being generated from a Facebook platform, I think you should have a third-party tracking system in place as well, so that you're not just believing what Google's or Facebook is telling you, but you've actually got the ability to track and measure that yourself as well, so that you're not getting blindsided. Because sometimes, you know, Facebook's figuring some things out, but a lot of the times it's because people just don't set up tracking correctly. Is a big part.
How do you break through the noise? There's so much advertising, especially digitally right now. Everywhere I go, I go to a news site and I see ads for a training program I may have looked at once, or I turn on my phone. Everywhere I go, there's ads. So how do you disrupt the marketplace and break through the noise?
There is a lot of noise, and there is a lot of what we refer to as ad blindness, right?
Mm-hmm. People just don't see them. I like that.
And so here's the reason why. You know, if I'm a 25-year-old woman and I'm scrolling through my Facebook feed and I see a product for a 50-year-old man, I'll leave it up to your imagination what you want. Why would you want to engage with that ad?
Mm-hmm. You wouldn't.
So, I mean, you get the point. The point is, get the right ad in front of the right people. And guess what? They do engage because you're giving them something that they want to see and something that they need, right? And so, again, that brings us back to the same points that we've already made. Stop treating it like a media buy and sticking a billboard. It's like putting a billboard up on the freeway. Yeah, maybe 5% of the people seeing that are actually the exact people you want to see it, but the other 95% are not. Mm-hmm. You don't need to do that on Google or Facebook anymore. You can get it so refined and get your messaging so dialed in that you're not, A, wasting the money for other people to see it that don't need to see it, and then B, you just got to quickly iterate on that, because you can't push the same message to someone on Facebook for a month in a row, mm-hmm. right? You need to kind of change it up and see what they're willing to engage and buy from. And so we iterate quickly, and you just got to nail down that targeting, because there's no reason to waste as much as happening online right now.
Next up is Richard C. Wilson. Richard was inspired by one of Jeffrey's talks, and if you've ever seen Jeffrey live, you certainly understand that. He's actually going to be live in Charlotte, North Carolina, June 14th and 15th. If you want to get tickets to go see him live then, you can go to cgittimer.com/Charlotte. But Richard was inspired to dominate a market that before he arrived had virtually been untapped, and that market was family offices. Now, family offices are essentially, they work to protect the wealth of very wealthy families. It's a fascinating sale in that you have to convince someone that you can be trusted to keep the wolves at bay, to keep a lot of money protected. We discussed that with Richard, and his answer offers insights that really apply to any sale.
What is a family office?
Sure. It's basically just a more holistic way to be managing your wealth if you're worth $10 million, $50 million, $300 million. So for example, if you made a 1% mistake on your taxes, but you're only worth $100,000, you know, who cares? And you probably made several of them and still who cares? But if you're worth $100 million and you make a 1% mistake,
yeah,
that could pay for a full-time team. And the people who are worth $100 million are being clawed at by everyone in the world. Their team needs them. People are trying to sell them things. They have commitments. They have assets. They have boats and houses. And they are more likely to make mistakes because of the complexity and the lack of time they have to do things holistically and carefully in every part of their life.
So the family office is basically making certain that the assets that you have, that you've compiled over a lifetime, are not only protected, but they are in growth mode so that they can become mm-hmm. a double, you know,
for
double,
the next generation.
Yeah.
So this is interesting, Richard. So you're protecting them from people that want to sell them things that maybe they don't need. How do you sell someone on a service that protects people from people who sell things?
One thing is I listen very, very closely. So if I was to sit down with Jeffrey and say, and ask him 60 questions and more questions based on that, it might come out that he's interested in buying apartment buildings in Charlotte or in
an area. How about a home in France?
Or a home in France, if it fits his goals. And so listening to the client a lot and then building a compass of where they want to go and why and their backstory and their values and objectives. And that way, the only ideas that are shown to them is the ones that make it through that filter. And for many people, it's where they made their money, like buying companies that are in the sales industry. So you can relate to it. You have a knowledge advantage, connection advantage, relationship advantage. But then usually there's a real estate component too, which has to be aligned with the risk parameters, the timeline of when they want to be passing on assets or liquidating assets or paying for college, et cetera.
Is there a life insurance aspect of it too?
For sure. And most importantly, it's upgrading their service provider so that, you know, your life insurance agent doesn't see you as your a one whale client and he has all lower end clients, because he won't be designing a practical approach for you. And same with a lawyer, same with, you know, accounting and back office administration. You need family office quality people in each spot, or they'll be holding you back, or you'll be wasting a lot of money.
So you select the provider, you may not be the provider.
Right. We actually don't provide any of that. We know national law firms, national accounting firms that serve hundreds of family offices. So you might have grown up with the CPA and he knows your business very, very well. You might not get rid of him. He could still do your bookkeeping or your accounting or part of your payroll, but you might want someone helping you with trust and estates or tax structuring or more complicated issues that have to do with like a family office level organization.
Got it. I don't know that I was familiar with the family office concept.
I sort of grew up around it in New York City. So
It just wasn't called a family office for me. Just different nomenclature.
That's fair.
Sure.
Is that something that has appeared over the past 100 years or the past 10 years?
Over the past 20, 25 years, the term has become more popular, but especially the last 5 years. You know, I started 11 years ago, but just last year, there was a billionaire based in New York who made his money in real estate. And I was talking to him here in Miami, and he had never heard the word family office before in his whole life. And he lives in Manhattan in the real estate space. So you'd think for sure he would have, you know? So I think a lot of people have not heard of the term, especially if they don't live in the U.S.
No, I don't feel so bad.
How do you build enough trust even to have that initial conversation? Because these people already have or think that they have their people.
Right. And they're on guard. People who have lots of money.
Totally on guard, especially if you're trying to talk to them about their money. So how do you even begin that conversation to get your foot in the door?
I mean, somebody from Goldman Sachs came in and they said, how do we hunt down more family offices? And I said, well, you don't. You have to attract them to you. Could be the Excedrin for their migraines. Yeah. So I just look for different flavors of migraines, knee pain, et cetera. And then we try to create the different color pills for that so that they are coming to me as an authority person and they're cold calling me and emailing me.
And so what do you do to attract them?
So one thing as simple as, you know, I started out not very intelligent about how to navigate the family office space. I wrote a book called The Family Office Book, and I wrote it for Wiley so I could feel credible. Then I realized the only book sales were done by me. So I wrote a book called The Single Family Office. And I was like, okay, no one's written a book on that topic before. So I'll be the first one to do it and interview 30 single family offices, which grew my credibility, my connections. But then I got smarter and said, well, the people who don't have as many gatekeepers and they just had a liquidity event are the most valuable, and I can add the most valuable to them, value to them. So I wrote a book with a very simple title, How to Start a Family Office. And no one else on planet Earth, I guess, bothered to put in, you know, a few weekends of work to write a book on that topic. And so now when you search that on Google, you'll find my book, and we're able just to have a one-to-one match with that intent of someone wanting to do that and then providing them value. And then they lean in and want to potentially work together in some way. So that's why I was excited to do this podcast, because my business literally would not exist without, you know, Gittimer's materials. And I read your stuff back when I was in college. And I went to your events back when I was in college. And there was one line in one of your books where you said, I'll give away my best secret of all, out of all my books, the most powerful thing I could tell anybody. And none of you guys are going to follow it. And none of my competitors are going to follow it. So I'll just tell you, you know, is to give away value consistently every month, every week, be giving away value. And in a year or two, you'll be a local expert. 2 to 4 years, you'll be a regional expert. And in 5-7 years, you're going to be a global expert. And I remember reading that. And I said, I'm going to be the son of a bitch that does that. And now I've done it. I'm here in your podcast.
Cool.
Oh, man. I am excited about this next clip from Mark England, the founder of Procabulary. Now, Mark's theories on the power and influence of our own language are super interesting to me. And it was to a lot of our listeners as well who commented on this episode. And it doesn't hurt that he has one of the single best voices that we've ever had on the show. Truly a joy to listen to.
You know what else? Negative thinking and stress responses, and it's called coastal breathing or shallow breathing or labored breathing does. It also decreases someone's ability to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And we've all seen someone drive in their car and they get stressed out. Maybe they're late. And what do? They turn the volume down because they can't even hear themselves think, and they get all uptight and up on the steering wheel. And how important is it, Jeffrey, to be able to listen, like really listen to what your prospect is saying?
So give us two tips. If you're a diehard out there, what do you do when you're stuck in that thought pattern?
Be more realistic when your shit hits your own fan.
Yep.
Write down the conversation that you are having in your mind in conversational English. Get it from your internal world to your external world on paper. Just that is the most reliable way to begin to dispel, which means to cast out, the negativity that we all create for ourselves when we speak and think in a certain way.
He doesn't want to say when shit hits your fan.
Right. But we do. Don't worry
about
it.
It's okay. We'll say it for you.
Yes. When shit hits the fan, get the conversation externalized on paper. And then it goes from something, because yes, it's the conversation, but it's also the repetition of the conversation. So how many times am I thinking about that negative thing?
I agree.
It's a feedback.
I totally agree. And the more you see the negative, the deeper it goes
down a rabbit hole.
Yeah. It goes down a rabbit hole. And now that thought process is out on a paper, out on a piece of paper, and it's got a definitive beginning and a definitive end, then I see it for more of what it is. I literally have created breathing room. I've created perspective. And then just a little bit of education about what words are inflaming my imagination and creating this stress, then I can make a couple of adjustments in my language and I get a better response from myself. So people that are into performance, this is a performance-enhancing tool.
So the challenge that you have is when you're in that negative zone, what can you define for yourself rather than blame other people for the circumstance? You take responsibility for it. You write it down. You look for your other choices, and you go, wait, let me take this path instead of that path.
Yes. You absolutely give yourself options. And to talk about negativity, how did you phrase it, Jeffrey? Negativity, it blocks creativity.
Yeah.
We've all had the experience of buying a new car or riding around in a new car, and then we start to see that car more and more out and about.
All of a sudden you see it everywhere.
All of a sudden you see it everywhere. You're like, wait a minute, what's going on? Where's this car
everyone has
coming from? How did this happen?
They were always there.
They were always there. And what I've done is I've focused my attention onto that particular vehicle, and we have a piece of hardware in our brain. It's called the reticular activating system. And it is designed to find whatever it is programmed and whatever we deem necessary, whatever we focus on, whether it's a new car or it's the same way that people learn to see opportunities. Mm-hmm. Once we see opportunities, then we start to see other opportunities because our reticular activating system is now focused in on them. And if I'm looking for opportunities, I'm dismissing negative situations, negative people. It's the same thing. If I'm looking for let's say BMW X5s, I start to see more and more of those around. What else am I not seeing?
Mm-hmm.
Blue trucks, green Suburbans.
Well, when I had my first MG, the sports car, it turns out that all MG owners wave to each other when they're going by.
Who knew?
Yeah, right. Until I got the car and I'm like, why is everybody waving at me? Oh, wait. That's like part of the deal.
Yeah.
And there was no internet that you could go to. There was no, you know, this was in the 60s.
So cool.
I'm waving at everybody all of a sudden. And I noticed there's hundreds of MGs out there.
Is it the same thing with proficient sellers?
Oh,
no.
Yeah. If you're
we hate each other.
We're successful people.
Yeah,
nod. You want to be around them. Oh, you got an MG too? Tell me about when did you get that? And you've got an extra detail on that. Let me know more.
I'll bet you Tesla drivers do it, but I'll bet you Chevy drivers don't.
Jeep drivers do.
They do?
Jeep drivers, people that have Jeeps, they wave.
People in Charlotte, North Carolina, or the surrounding 1,000-mile radius, I need your help. I'm going to be doing two public seminars here in Charlotte, June the 14th, a leadership seminar, a sales leadership seminar, and June the 15th, a public sales mastery seminar, and you're invited. All you have to do is buy a ticket and show up. I'm going to be talking about things that will take you through this year and the next decade, and what you have to do to maintain your leadership position, set the standard, and make the money that you're hoping to earn. Go to cgittimer.com, cgittimer.com/Charlotte.
Hashtag Gittimer is back.
It's going to be a hootenanny.
Hashtag Gittimer is hootenanny.
Hashtag I'm going to rock your sales world.
A few weeks ago, we had the pleasure of hanging out with John Lee Dumas, a pioneer in this field of podcasting that we are now exploring here on Sell or Die with you, our diehards. He is the host of Entrepreneur on Fire. That's a must listen. Add that to your podcast list. In this clip, we discuss his beginnings in podcasting so many years ago and how surprising the growth of podcasting has been to him.
When you started in podcasting, it was like the Mojave Desert. There was not a hell of a lot going on. What triggered you to say, "Oh, this is my foundation now"?
It's one of those things where I just got podcasting from the beginning, and that was as a consumer. I was just like, "Okay, like I'm in the car all the time, and I'm being forced to listen to some crappy sports talk radio in a city whose sports teams I don't even like." So I'm like in San Diego, which is a city I love, but I hate the Chargers. I hate the Padres. I don't care about any of them, but like there's nothing else on. I'm not going to listen to like Miley Cyrus sing another song on the top 40 radio. You know, I'm not going to listen, you know, to some sports talk radio. There's like nothing that was out there that I was like interested in. So I started listening to audiobooks, and I was just like, well, this is getting expensive because audiobooks aren't cheap. And podcasting, I just found it. And I'm like, oh, wait, this is free on demand, meaning I can press play and pause when I want to. And it's targeted, meaning I can choose the exact show I want to listen to and listen to that. And I found the great shows and I subscribed to them. And I just got the medium immediately. Again, even though, like you said, it was the Mojave Desert, it was hard to download them. There weren't that many shows, so I didn't have the biggest variety in the world. But I just got the medium. I knew it was going to be big on some level. You know, I did not think it was going to be big, you know, to the level that it is now and have the kind of legs it has had. You know, it feels like it's been the golden age of podcasting for like the past 4 or 5 years. But you know, it's just one of those things that I got from a very early stage. And I said, you know what, if I can consume this content at the level that I'm consuming it, and there's a show that doesn't exist that I wish did, which was a daily show interviewing entrepreneurs, why not fill that void? I'm going to suck. I'm not going to be good as a host at all. But if I do it every day of the week, I'll get a little bit better every single time.
Great stuff there from John Lee Dumas. And if you are interested in learning more about podcasting, email sellordie@gittimer.com because we are hosting podcast workshops now, and we are also starting a Sell or Die network for people who are starting podcasts or who already have podcasts in the sales, business, and personal development space. Again, that email, sellordie@gittimer.com for more information. Now, there are guests we've had on multiple times on this show, but no guest has been on more than our friend Jeb Blunt. He owns Sales Gravy, which is a sales acceleration company. He is an author. His new book is all about objections. You can check it out on Amazon.com. There's a link to his book in the show notes. And in this clip, he digs deep on identifying the different types of objections and how to handle them with what he calls emotional control. You always learn something from Jeb. Take a listen.
But how you handle a prospecting objection, a time objection, is different than how you handle a buying commitment objection. That's another objection. So that's the, I've given you a proposal, which is a written or verbal offer to buy, and you've given me an objection. It might be a question. It might be a negotiation. But to the salesperson, it seems like something that's in the way.
It's a block.
Of moving forward.
Right. I refer to them, by the way, as barriers.
They're barriers.
Yeah.
Now, in between, you have micro-commitment objections.
Okay.
So if when we talk about asking, if you don't ask them to have the next meeting, to let you go on a tour of their facility, to let you take a look at their data and their numbers so that you can formulate a business case that gives them a reason to say, when can we get started? Would this be okay? A lot of times they'll get in the way of that, mostly because they don't feel value in it. So those are really low key low-risk objections, but they just don't see value in spending more time with you, usually because you're boring, because you spent the entire time talking. And then there are red herring objections, and red herring objections destroy salespeople. So they're at the beginning of a meeting, and they say, thank you very much, Mr. Gittimer, for spending 15 minutes with me today. My objective today is to do
– Move closer to the
move
mic.
Move closer to the mic, because apparently I haven't learned that yet. And so thank you for – my objective is this. What would you like to have on the agenda as well? And you go, you know, the last time I did business with you bastards, you overcharged me.
Yeah, yeah.
And then off to the races the salesperson goes, dealing with that.
Right.
And they blow their entire sales meeting. And at the end of the meeting, they end up with, you know what, I'll send me your prices, I'll call you, versus being in emotional control, taking that, whatever that is, putting it aside, getting the person engaged, have the questions.
Actually making an appointment to get back to the person with whatever the red herring was.
Exactly. Right, right. But those four types of objections, prospecting
objections.
You know
what a red herring is, by the way?
I do. It's a it was something that came from the Middle Ages. They would take dead fish and the hounds are running along, right?
Yeah.
And they would run the red herring across and the hounds would go and then it became it's a literary device that says, I'm taking you off the
I never knew.
It's
that.
Also the pre book that you get when someone's going to have a public offering.
Mm-hmm.
They call it a red herring because there's red in there where they haven't finalized all the stuff.
Oh, no way.
Yep. Wow, I didn't know that.
Well,
man.
For those of you just joining us.
If you're playing Trivial Pursuit, today is your day.
Bingo. Or if you're playing Jeopardy, I'm your clicker.
I can say this with a lot of confidence. No guest in the past 2 months has had more impact on the staff of this show than Hal Elrod. His Miracle Morning program has become part of all of our lives, and we've gotten so many notes from diehards out there who have been impacted by his podcast and the bonus episode. I mean, the interview was so good, was so jam-packed with inspiration, value, and insight that we had to split it up into two episodes. In this clip that we'll play for you today, he discusses his journey to running a marathon and how daily visualization played a key factor.
All right, the E is for exercise.
Wait a second. What do you when you visualize something?
Yeah.
So what you're saying is you have to visualize the steps, not just the ending.
Yeah. So I'll give you a specific example of how one of the first ways that I actually did this. Right after, so when I started doing the Miracle Morning, and I had this distinction around. I want level 10 success in every area of my life. I have to become a level 10 person.
Mm-hmm.
Then I downloaded one of those Wheel of Life things to kind of measure where am I at on a scale of 1 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I got clear, okay, I'm at a 4 in this area, I'm at an 8, 6 in this area, 7 in this area. And then I asked myself, what would a measurable result be that would be so out of my comfort zone that would scare me, but it was doable, that it would challenge me to become a level 10 person, right? And physically, I hated running. I had never run more than 1 mile in my life at a time, and that was only in PE class in high school when you had to run the mile, right? I mean, literally, hated running and hated walking. I didn't like walking places. I thought, wait a minute. My friend founded a charity called Front Row Foundation, and they were doing this. They do this run every year, and of course, I've never done it, and every year he invites me. I thought, what if I did a marathon? I don't even know the guy that I would have to become, the level 10 person, to run 26 miles in a day. And then after a few weeks of getting my head around that.
26.2.
There you go. Researching my books on how to do it and all that. Then I went, wait a minute. Everybody does a marathon. Not everybody, but a lot of people do a marathon. I have two friends that have done ultra marathons, 52 miles in a day.
Yeah.
I thought, if they did it, I can do it. Total bullshit logic. Doesn't make any sense.
Correct.
That was my, at the time, I was delusional. I thought, you know what? I'm going to do. So I thought, I'm going to commit publicly to my Miracle Morning community. Or no, I didn't have a Miracle Morning community, but just publicly on my Facebook and to the charity that I'm going to run 52 miles on this day to raise money for them. And so here's how visualization played into that. Every day I literally downloaded a picture of the Atlantic City Marathon from Google Images, the finish line, so I could actually visualize the real spot that I would be crossing the finish line. Again, there's value to that because I started to believe I can do it. I've seen it. But the most important part of my daily visualization was I would close my eyes and I would see myself walking into my bedroom, looking at the clock at 7 a.m. because that's when I had committed the win to run. Then I would see myself go in my closet, get dressed in my running clothes. Then I would visualize myself walking out of my house. This is like a 2-minute visualization. Walking out of my front door with a smile on my face, and I would literally generate the emotions inside of looking forward to that run. So let me pause for a second. The key is anything in your world that you want to use visualization for, that you want to accomplish, when you visualize yourself taking the daily activities, like making sales calls or whatever your activities are, right? See yourself enjoying the process or doing it with confidence or, you know, whatever, and then feel those emotions so that when it's time to do it, you've already gone there in your body. If there's a reason that the world's greatest athletes from when they were, you know, Tiger Woods when he was at the top of his game, or, you know, Michael Jordan, or, you know, today LeBron James or whatever, they visualize performing perfectly, right? And so then when they actually, and they go there emotionally in their body and their mind and their spirit. So when they get out on the court or on the field or whatever, they've already been there. And that's the same thing that you can take advantage of in your daily life. You get to the point, like I've gotten to the point where I don't actually, and I'm always transparent about this. Visualization is my weakest link. Like in the savers, it's the one that I struggle with the most for whatever reason. I don't even know why. So I actually don't do it every day. It's maybe the only saver that I don't do every day. I do it when I have something big, like if I'm giving a speech. I'll go into the room in the morning and I'll actually visualize, you know, and Jeffrey, you've probably done this, you know, but I'll stand on the stage and I'll visualize it full of people and I'll walk back and forth and visualize myself and I'll see people laughing in the front row, right? So I've gone there, and that way when I hit the stage, I'm a lot less nervous and I've already gone there, you know? So yeah, to your point, Jeffrey, I don't do it every day.
You get nervous before you talk?
No. No, not really. Hey, in a healthy way, but not really.
There you have it, the very best that we have to offer from April and May, but I encourage you, please go back and listen to those full episodes, because what you heard today was just the tip of the iceberg from really, I have to say, I think the past 2 months have offered us some of the best guests that we've ever had. And guess what? Coming up in June, July, August, we've got some amazing guests for you as well. The train keeps rolling here on Sell or Die. We're looking out for all of the diehards out there, helping you to earn more, to learn more. And this is going to be great. And we're going to get back on track. I can say that as the producer. We're going to have a Best of June episode for you at the end of this month. So no more skipping months. We're back on track. Thanks so much for listening to this special edition of Sell or Die. Tell a friend, help us out, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, wherever you get podcasts. Just search Sell or Die. If you want to see Jeffrey Gittimer live, make sure to head over to cgittimer.com/Charlotte and check out everything that Jen has to offer on sales in a New York Minute.com. We're going to be back for you on Thursday. We have a sales manager spotlight on Thursday. Yeah, another sales manager spotlight. Those have been one of our most talked about segments, because you're hearing from real sales managers telling you their best tips and their biggest struggles. So you're going to learn a lot tomorrow. Make sure you're subscribed. Make sure you're telling your friends about this podcast. Hey, just don't tell your competition. Thanks so much for listening.
Diehards, thank you for listening to Sell or Die. If you like what you heard, make sure to subscribe and rate this podcast. Give it a star on Overcast and tell a friend.
Tell both your friends. Just don't tell your competition. You can follow me on Twitter @Gittimer and Jen @SalesInAnyMinute.
Send your sales questions to sellordie@gittimer.com. We'll be back next week with Motivation Monday and another amazing guest.
Until then, I'm Jeffrey Gittimer.
And I'm Jen Gluckow.
And we're reminding you to get out there and sell or die.
Even if your ass falls off.